This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, our own Michael Ratner will give us a response to the verdict in the Bradley Manning case. He's been in the courtroom, and he's been following the case since its inception. We'll hear an update on the more than 600 inmates at Pelican Bay Prison in California who are refusing to eat. We'll interview attorney Jules Lobel, who's bringing a class action suit along with the Center for Constitutional Rights, challenging solitary confinement and security unit conditions in California's Pelican Bay Prison. We'll hear a presentation from Professor Michael Zweig, who spoke recently at the Left Forum in New York with an analysis on the Occupy movement. Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, from the inception, you've been one of the few individuals who's followed every aspect of the Bradley Manning case, making multiple trips to Fort Meade to be in the courtroom, providing analysis on Law and Disorder and many other media outlets. And now we have a verdict. Military Judge Denise Lind found Bradley Manning not guilty on charges of aiding the enemy for releasing hundreds of thousands of documents to WikiLeaks for publication on the internet. But she convicted Manning of 6 counts of violating the Espionage Act. What do you make of this verdict?
Heidi, thanks for the introduction. This is Michael Ratner, and as you've said, Heidi, I've been going back and forth to the trial and, of course, represent Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. And Bradley Manning, according to his own testimony, was one of the main sources of documents for WikiLeaks, some 700,000 documents that were uploaded to WikiLeaks. I've been doing a lot of media lately on this issue, getting into debates about it, whether Bradley Manning should be prosecuted, etc. I take a very firm position here. He should never have been tried in the first place, not for espionage or aiding the enemy. He shouldn't have been tried for anything. He's a hero. He's a whistleblower. And anyone who says otherwise is ignoring the criminality of the United States and the secrecy that it keeps about that criminality. And there's a legal basis for me saying that. He is a whistleblower. He publicly exposed the truths about the nature of this country, particularly its human rights violations, its criminality, and its corruption. That constitutes a whistleblower, and whistleblowing is a legal defense to whatever kinds of crimes the United States wanted to try him. He was an idealistic soldier. He saw horrible things. He acted on his conscience, and that's a whistleblower in the classic sense of the word. What's really disturbing about this is the public debate about this. The public debate, even from a lot of liberals, are, well, yes, he acted on his conscience. He was idealistic, but he took a risk. He knew what he was doing, and he should at least get some punishment. We can't just have people going around revealing classified information. Even liberals say that. They simply say government shouldn't have been as harsh about prosecuting him. So you see the New York Times saying he shouldn't get such a heavy sentence. You have other people saying he shouldn't be prosecuted for espionage. But in fact, my position, and the right position here, I believe, is that he shouldn't have been prosecuted at all. Well, let's look for a second at why I say that. Not only because he was a whistleblower, but look at what he revealed. First, we've all seen, I hope we have, the collateral murder video, the killing of 2 Reuters journalists, and I believe 10 other civilians, just shot with a gung-ho bloodlust, as Bradley Manning described it. Those crimes were never really investigated, and no one was prosecuted for them, and yet it was cold-blooded murder taking place from an Apache helicopter on the streets of Baghdad. Then think about what the Iraq war logs revealed. All this material from Bradley Manning to WikiLeaks. Iraq war logs, 20,000 more civilians killed in Iraq than the United States has said were killed. That alone, that fact, apart from the terrible tragedy of those civilians being killed, that fact caused the government of Iraq to not sign another status of forces agreement with the United States, because a status of forces agreement would have given immunity to U.S. troops. And after all of these killings of civilians, Iraq said, we're not going to do it. Because there was no immunity for U.S. troops, the U.S. said, we're not staying in Iraq. Think about how important that is. Then there was a story within the last year, taken from the WikiLeaks documents, really the Iraq war logs, from Bradley Manning, about torture centers run in Iraq in 2003, 2004, around that period. U.S. knew about them, helped set them up. Hundreds of people were taken for torture every single month. General Petraeus, who was in Iraq at the time, was aware of it. Nothing happened as a result. The only reason we knew about that is because of Bradley Manning. And then, of course, we have the tables about the corruption of the Ben Ali government in Tunisia. The Tunisian government, the current government, gives credit to those cables for bringing down Ben Ali and beginning the Arab Spring. That's just a little bit of what Bradley Manning has revealed to all of us about the criminality of our own country, and information we ought to know and debate, as Bradley Manning has said. I look at the debate that's going on now about, well, he was just prosecuted too heavily. Very few people are saying he shouldn't have been prosecuted at all. But in fact, of course, that's the case, because he's brought out material that had to be brought out, that in a secret government, which is what we have right now, a secret government of criminality and blood, really, we need to know what it's doing. But in addition, and here's a second point, and it's a really critical one in my view, people are crying for Bradley Manning's scalp, or they're saying, well, at least you have to get him a little bit, otherwise you're going to have, you know, people just willy-nilly giving up classified material, etc. Now, before I would ever, ever say that someone like Bradley Manning would be prosecuted for anything, I would have to say, first, let's prosecute the Bush torture team. Then let's look at the people calling for the prosecution and prosecute them for the war crimes they've committed. Let's look at the illegal war in Iraq that's killed hundreds of thousands, cost trillions of dollars, and was an illegal war to boot. None of those people are being prosecuted. People like Hillary Clinton, who we maybe perhaps can't be prosecuted for voting for the war, but she, like others, Bill Keller at the New York Times, are what people like Tony Jute, the famous writer, called Bush's useful idiots, the liberals who went along with the war. So every time I hear people saying Bradley has to be prosecuted, I say to them, first, he's a truth teller. Secondly, and importantly, I don't want to see a hair touched on the head of Bradley Manning until we start. I never want to see it touched. We shouldn't even be talking about it until this country starts prosecuting its own war criminals. It's outrageous. It's one-sided debate. And it's incredible to me that is the focus. That's a main point I wanted to make. A second point, which I often hear in these debates, is these tables, these revelations, the Iraq war logs, the Afghan war logs, they cause tremendous harm to the United States. They put people in jeopardy. I heard it again. I had a debate with P.J. Crawley, the former State Department official, who the one who, at least to his credit, exposed the torture or criticized the torture of Bradley Manning in prison. Since then, he's become, you know, pretty typical, you know, liberal, calling for Bradley Manning's prosecution, saying he knows there was harm in the field. Of course, he worked at the State Department at the very time that Hillary Clinton was exposed as spying on the diplomats at the United Nations, getting their credit card numbers, their airline reservations, and everything else. That's who he worked for, apart from Hillary's role in the war. So P.J. Crawley is up there on the air today with me saying, harm, harm, harm. And I said, well, you know, you're just wrong. There's been no evidence that there's any harm that was caused, any serious harm, anyone killed from this. And various agencies of the government have acknowledged that. It's a made-up fiction. A third major point I want to make is this whole question of aiding the enemy in espionage. You know, I see these headlines in the paper, mixed verdict or relief that aiding the enemy was he wasn't convicted of that. And I say to myself, mixed verdict? What are we talking about? The only reason we consider there to be anything positive in this verdict, and it's very, very little, minuscule, you'd need a magnifying glass to see it, is because Bradley Manning was so utterly overcharged to begin with a ridiculous charge of aiding the enemy, that was sustained by the judge on a motion to dismiss and let go to the end until she finally acquitted him of it, that we're relieved that actually that he wasn't convicted of it. I mean, there was an old expression they used to say, for some people, four walls are three too many. which is the idea that rather than give them a try, you just put them up against the wall and shoot them. That's the equivalent of what aiding the enemy charge was like for Bradley Manning. Had he been convicted of it, it would have been the equivalent of, for some people, four walls are three too many. But why I say we shouldn't look at this as a mixed verdict or be heavily relieved, yes, it's true, Bradley could have suffered a life sentence for that. The death penalty was out there, even though the government said it wasn't going to ask for it. He could have still gotten it. But despite the acquittal of that one charge, there was one other charge he was acquitted of. He was convicted of 20 charges. Six of them were espionage charges, each of them carrying 10 years. Six of them were theft of government documents, each of them carrying 10 years. He is subject now to 134 years in prison. And he was charged as a leaker, as a whistleblower, with espionage. This is the first ever conviction of anyone in the United States who was a whistleblower, who was a, quote, leaker for espionage, first time ever. And you ask yourself, why did that happen? I thought we had this liberal president, President Obama. Well, the story is that Obama has been the worst on whistleblowing and on journalists who report whistleblowing of any president in our history. It's really outrageous. We've had now seven, I think, espionage prosecutions. It's true, two of them began under Bush, but we've had more under Obama than all other presidents combined. In addition, what Obama has done and his administration, Eric Holder and company, they have tried to erase the line between whistleblower and journalist. So, for example, in the case of my client, Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, they've tried to essentially say that Julian Assange and WikiLeaks were in a conspiracy with Bradley Manning. And that's the way they're trying to get publishers and journalists indicted for conspiracy to commit espionage. Of course, there's no evidence that Julian Assange and WikiLeaks were in a conspiracy, but what they did at the Bradley Manning trial, they dragged WikiLeaks and Julian Assange through as much mud as they could. They made statements such as Bradley Manning was taking orders from Julian Assange. Bradley Manning used the WikiLeaks Most Wanted list to search for what he needed, et cetera, et cetera. None of it true, none of it proven, but it tells you how the government has WikiLeaks and Julian Assange in their sights. We all know, of course, that they've attempted to destroy WikiLeaks. It's more probable than not that there's an indictment against Julian Assange as we speak. And that's why you saw in part of the Bradley Manning trial, there was an effort made to try and distinguish or separate Julian Assange from newspapers like the New York Times, the Washington Post, etc. Those are real journalists, according to the prosecutor. WikiLeaks is not journalism. Sad for the government, though, they couldn't prove it, and a major part of the testimony of a man named Yochai Benkler, a professor from Harvard, pointed out that WikiLeaks does practice journalism. It's a type of journalist that has emerged since the Internet, and there's no way in the world you can say it's not playing an important journalistic function. The government's going to have trouble with this, but that is their effort right now to try and merge that line between whistleblower and journalist. No one should be prosecuted who's a whistleblower. To the extent, though, the Obama administration thinks they can do that, they're going to try and push journalists, particularly WikiLeaks, toward that as co-conspirators. And we've seen that with two other cases that are important to bring out under the Obama administration. One is the James Rosen case. He's a Fox News reporter. He had a source that he was getting and reporting information from. When they wanted to get his phone records, what did the government do? What did Holder himself sign off on? But an affidavit to get a search warrant to get the phone records of James Fox, a reporter. What did the affidavit say? It said, James Fox is a co-conspirator with his source. That's pretty strong evidence about the way in which the Obama administration and Holder are treating journalists. Then you have the well-known journalist James Risen, New York Times reporter, exposed the warrantless wiretapping. There's now a trial going on in the case of another leaker, alleged leaker, whistleblower named Jeffrey Sterling. A trial is going on in Maryland right now. James Risen was called to testify in the trial about who his source was. He refused. The case went up to the Court of Appeals on his refusal, and he just lost in a 2-1 decision. But what was really shocking about the decision and frightening is that the judge said about James Risen essentially that he's a co-conspirator. He started by saying James Risen saw this crime because obviously he was the reporter who had the source. The crime couldn't have been committed without James Risen. How far do you have to go next indict people like James Risen, James Rosen, and Julian Assange? So this is a time, really, in which we all have to understand there is great fear being sowed by the U.S. government, Obama, Holder, and others, both with regard to whistleblowers and with regard to journalists. Two other points as I close here. One is we're seeing now a 2 or 3 week period in which the sentencing will occur of Bradley Manning. As I said, he faces 136 years now, or 134 years, and the prosecution puts on witnesses. Most of them will be in secret, probably trying to argue, you know, the security implications of what Bradley Manning did, et cetera, et cetera. The defense will put on witnesses trying to mitigate the sentence so it won't be as long. Defense may have as many as 20 witnesses. I presume there'll be people from his family, other journalists, experts on national security, et cetera, people on talking about the importance of what Bradley Manning did, and then the judge will give a sentence. You know, obviously we hope for the shortest sentence he can get. He's done 3 years. He pleaded guilty initially himself to possible 20 years. I have no idea at this point what he will get. Obviously the ideal would be time served and let him walk out of the jail the hero that he should be. But it's really a time of repression in the country and a time when people who act on their conscience are being hit very, very hard. And that leads me to the last point. So you have Bradley Manning in prison, perhaps for a very long time. I hope not. Jeremy Hammond, who's uploaded the Stratford emails, the ones on the private intelligence company, he's facing a 10-year sentence. You have Barrett Brown, also in prison, for transferring a link that was that anybody could have transferred to the Stratford documents. You have Julian Assange sitting in the Ecuadorian embassy, not able to walk out because he will be on a one-way ticket to where Bradley Manning is, where Barrett Brown is, and where Jeremy Hammond is, and he will be perhaps facing life in jail. And then, of course, you have Ed Snowden, who at least for now is able to circulate at the transit lounge of the Moscow airport and hopefully will soon have some form of asylum in Russia. So you're seeing the sledgehammer that the U.S. is taking to truth tellers and the importance of the truths that are being revealed. In terms of thinking about Bradley Manning as my final thought, Bradley Manning was the first of the big whistleblowers, critical material to all our work. WikiLeaks was the first and probably still the remaining a major publisher of important documents, whether leaked or not leaked, but documents that we all ought to know about. They really, in some way, have opened the door to other whistleblowers, particularly to Ed Snowden. As much as the government is trying to repress people, put the genie back in the bottle, as Shakespeare once said in one of his plays, the truth will out, and that is what we're seeing today.
Michael, thank you so much for providing really day-to-day, week-to-week analysis of this important case and the implications that it has for freedom of information in the United States. Last month, prisoners at Pelican Bay Prison in California went on another hunger strike to protest solitary confinement and security unit conditions. What exactly does solitary confinement mean at Pelican Bay? Prisoners spend 22 to 24 hours a day in a cramped, concrete, windowless cell. Their food is often rotten, and temperatures are extremely cold or exceedingly hot. Within 15 days, such conditions can cause psychological damage. Jules Obel, who represents the prisoners at Pelican Bay in a lawsuit challenging long-term solitary confinement in California prisons, says inmates land in solitary confinement not for crimes they were convicted of, not for any rule violation or violent act while in prison, but based on the slimmest pretext of affiliation with a gang. Jules Obel is a professor at the University of Pittsburgh Law School and joins us to give us more details on the hunger strike and the lawsuit that he and the Center for Constitutional Rights have brought. Jules, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
We have quite a situation in California with over 630 inmates on a hunger strike and 9 California prisons being a part of this hunger strike, entering now, it will be the 4th week. Is this unusual for people to be held in solitary conditions for so long in California?
It's unusual around the country. Around the country, there are about 80,000 people, prisoners at any one time, who are in some form of solitary confinement. In California alone, there are 4,000. What makes California somewhat unusual is that there are a large number of prisoners who've been in solitary confinement for over a decade and many over 20 years. In California, in just one prison, Pelican Bay, there are over 400 prisoners who've been there for over 10 years and about 80 who've been there for 2 decades. That's one thing that's unusual. Second, in California, the conditions of they're placed under a draconian. For example, in these cells that my clients are in, there are no windows. So people spend 20 years without being able to see trees or birds or grass or hardly any other people. That's relatively unusual throughout the country to have a whole prison without any windows. In fact, Shane Bauer, who was an American who was held in Iran for months and then finally released, he was held in solitary, and he called it an awful experience. And he toured Pelican Bay Prison, and the prison guards asked him, was there something different about the situation in Pelican Bay compared to Iran and your conditions? And he thought about it for a few minutes, and he said, there are no windows here. In Iran, at least they had a window. They get no phone calls. It's a very draconian situation. And finally, in California, what makes it unique is they put in thousands of people simply for gang affiliation. You don't have to have committed any crime in prison. I mean, you have to have obviously committed crime to get into prison, but you don't have to have committed any disciplinary infraction in prison. But simply if you have a piece of artwork, which they say is gang-related, or a tattoo that's gang-related, or you get a birthday card from somebody who's a member of a gang, or your name is found on a list, or some informant says you're affiliated with the gang, all of those could land you in solitary confinement for years or even decades.
Now, in a few minutes, we're going to talk about your lawsuit, but it seems to me that most of our listeners are aware that the United Nations Rapporteur for Human Rights has called solitary confinement, I think, after just a few months, a form of torture. I wonder how California can get away with such duration of solitary confinement without constant legal challenges.
Yeah, well, two things about that. One is there are things which society will look back on 100 years from now and say, how could this have been done in a civilized society? I mean, we look back at slavery now and say that. We look back at segregation and say that. I think 100 years from now, people will look back and say, how could a society have tolerated this form of torture for decades without anything being done about it? The courts have been pretty unreceptive up till now to claims challenging solitary confinement because, you know, it's seen as a security measure in prisons, and in many prisons, the climate is one that was similar to the climate around terrorism right after September 11th, namely anything that has to be done in terms of security is warranted, and we have to give great discretion to the prison officials. So that's, I'd say, how they've been getting away with it up till now. I think there are more challenges now, and I think the issue of solitary confinement is getting onto the media and to the mainstream radar screen, and I think we're going to see changes in the next few years.
I understand that some of the inmates have been asking for salt tablets. Do you think there's any chance that officials will force feed it at any point in the future?
They say that they will, but only when the prisoner loses consciousness and if the prisoner doesn't have a directive which says don't force feed me. So if the prisoner loses consciousness and doesn't have anything that they've said about force feeding, California will force feed them at that point. now is these folks are on a no solid food hunger strike, and they've been willing to take various liquids, salt tablets, vitamins, things like that. And we had to put pressure on California because for the first couple of weeks, even though the prisoners were willing to take various liquid nutrients, California was denying them that. So we finally got things like some a little packets of Gatorade and vitamins and salt tablets.
Now, Jules, tell us about your lawsuit. When did you bring this, and what are you challenging specifically?
We looked at the situation in California that I described, and we also knew that 2 years ago, hundreds of thousands of prisoners went on hunger strike in California protesting this and were promised reforms, which were never delivered. And we decided that time was right for a class action lawsuit. And we brought the lawsuit in May of last year, May 2012. And we claimed two things. One is that to keep people in these kind of conditions for over a decade is cruel and unusual punishment. It's a violation of the Eighth Amendment. In fact, in my view, it should be a violation of the Eighth Amendment even for a year or two. But there is judicial precedent in California which said in the past that a year or two didn't violate the Eighth Amendment. So we said, well, okay, even if a year or two doesn't violate the Eighth Amendment, 10 years, 20 years must surely violate the Eighth Amendment. And the second thing is put somebody in these kind of conditions without any act of violence on their part while in prison, but simply because they're a gang affiliate. We think disproportionate punishment. And finally, the process they have to decide who gets in and who gets out is virtually meaningless. And they don't have any meaningful way out of these situations except to become an informant. Because California's view is once you're in the gang, you are always in a gang. And the only way out is to actually inform on your fellow gang members, which most of the guys, they won't do, because it puts them and their families at risk. So we brought this claim under Eighth Amendment and due process challenges, and the state made a motion to dismiss the past year, and in April of this year, that motion was denied by the judge, who wrote an excellent opinion allowing us to go forward. We have a motion for class certification, which means that the case will be able to continue as a class action. That's going to be heard by the judge on August 22nd.
Oh, that's soon. And are you covering how many correctional facilities in the state?
Well, the case only deals with one, and it's the most notorious, and that's Pelican Bay. But there are 1,000 prisoners confined in solitary confinement for many, many years at Pelican Bay. That's where the heart of the protest lies right now, even though it's spread throughout California.
Are family members and concerned community members and activists rallying much around this locally?
There is a very strong network of family members who are protesting the conditions that their loved ones have been placed in, which includes that it's very, very hard for family members to visit because they deliberately placed this prison, Pelican Bay State Penitentiary, in a place where it's 7 hours from the nearest major metropolitan area. By car. So it's deliberately isolated. So the family members are very, very involved, and there's a tremendous protest both in L.A. and in Northern California around in support of the hunger strike.
And do you have legislative support at all on this issue?
There are some legislators in California that have been holding hearings and speaking out on the issue, but by and large, the state legislature has been quiet. The one move that the state legislature did make, which was to allow the media to interview people in solitary, because right now there's a blanket rule by California that they wouldn't allow the New York Times or any media folks to go into the California solitary units and interview people, except the people who they select
right, to
allow them to interview. And the state legislature passed a bill which lifted the ban. And Governor Jerry Brown vetoed the bill, so the media still can't get in.
Right. And I would imagine, though, even if they did, there would be some type of retaliation for inmates who spoke out.
There would be, but you you'd get plenty of inmates who would speak out because people now are in open protest.
Right,
so
right.
You get people speaking out, but it's like a gulag there in the sense that they don't want any exposure or any media attention being placed on them, which is why these guys have to go on hunger strike to get any media attention.
A couple of years ago, we read about the overpopulation in penal institutions in California, and I thought there were efforts to let some individuals out earlier. How does this solitary issue jive with the rest of the overpopulation? Because isn't it more costly to keep someone in solitary confinement?
Yeah, it's way more costly to keep somebody in solitary confinement. It's a waste of taxpayer resources, quite frankly, to keep people who have never done anything seriously wrong in prison in this kind of condition. But the way it jives is that, in my view, is that in general, California has been resistant to any change. The overcrowding was ordered by the Supreme Court, was found by the Supreme Court to be unconstitutional, and the Supreme Court ordered that the overcrowding be alleviated. California made minimal reforms and now says the problem is cured. A panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, a three-judge panel, has ruled that their efforts were insufficient and are now appealing against the Supreme Court. California, on a whole range of issues, including solitary confinement, has just circled the wagon, said we're not going to really change. The only way to get them to change is really to force them to change.
I read that state authorities have deployed independent monitors into 9 of the California facilities to sort of monitor the inmate hunger strike. There were allegations, I think, that strikers, especially those who were seen as leaders, were being blasted with cold air to weaken their condition as they went without eating. And then Renee Hansen, a spokesperson for the Inspector General, said their agency found no basis for such a complaint, although Ann Wiles, a lawyer representing some of the inmates, said that they were turned off, of course, when the monitors were there. Do you think these monitors are going to find anything of significance?
Let me say that the reason that they're monitored there is because California is under a medical receivership. The whole California medical system is under a receivership. And the medical receiver, I believe, ordered it to be monitored there, not California.
Right.
But I do think the monitors are useful in curbing the worst abuses that are occurring. But I, as you pointed out, California can do things when the monitors are not around, and then when the monitors come around, they can clean up their act. But I do think it's helpful to have these monitors.
Jules, if people want to read more about your lawsuit, is there a website we can go to?
Yeah, I would go to the Center for Constitutional Rights website. I'm the president of the center, and the center is bringing this case, and we have a lot of material at ccrjustice.org.
Okay, ccrjustice.org for information on this important lawsuit. Jules Lobel, once again, it's a pleasure to have you on, and best of luck with this case.
And thanks for interviewing me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
We go now to hear a presentation by Michael Zweig at the Left Forum in New York. Michael is professor of economics at Stony Brook University and director of the Center for Study of Working Class Life. We last interviewed him about his DVD, Why Are We in Afghanistan? But today we hear his analysis on the Occupy movement. Let's have a listen.
Our last speaker is Michael Zweig. He's a professor of economics and director of the Center for the Study of Working Class Life. His most recent books are The Working Class Majority, America's Best Kept Secret, and What's Class Got to Do with It? American Society in the 21st Century. Michael was a founding member of the Students for Democratic Society and the Union for Radical Political Economics. He's active in his union, the United University Professions, which is part of the AFT, and he was named Citizen of the Year by the Suffolk Times for his writing and community organizing on Eastern Long Island. Michael Zweig.
Yeah, Citizen of the Year twice.
What a guy.
What a guy. Hello, everybody. It's good to be here in Left Forum, and thank you to Francis and to others who put this book together. I'm here because somebody saw that I had spoken down at Occupy at Zuccotti Park and thought, that belongs in this book. And so here I am in the book. So what I want to do is say just a little bit about what is in the piece that I have in that book, which is more or less the thoughts that I was trying to bring to the Occupy movement down there on Zuccotti Park, which happened to be on November 14th at the library in Zuccotti Park, on November 14th, 2011, which is the day that the NYPD came and destroyed the park. And it happened to be the day that I got off-prints for the second edition of the Working Class Majority, which I brought down to the park to give to the library. I gave them two copies, and that was what went off to the trash bins. And so it's nice that the piece that I've got in this book is what was said at that event. It's a little nice piece there. At any rate, what Occupy did in bringing us this 1%, 99% formulation really captured a lot of the heart of America. And I think it did that because really for the first time in many, many years, what was going on there was that the arrow of struggle was being pointed up to the top, to the people who run the country, rather than down to the people who do the work. The responsibility for the problems of our society were being laid at the doorstep of the corporate and financial elites of the society, rather than the public sector workers, and rather than unionized workers in auto plants, rather than the people who are doing the everyday work of American life. Those were the people who are being scapegoated by the 1%. And the turning of that upside down is what I think really did galvanize the attention of the American people. And we're still in that mode. That has not gone away. So that 1%, 99% formulation is really a metaphor. And metaphors are always tricky things. Metaphors are never really precise. Metaphors don't really tell you what is actually happening. They're metaphors. And they're powerful, but I think that it becomes important to dig into the reality of that metaphor, which is what I was trying to do in that Occupy talk. So if we say, who is this 1%? Usually it's represented in terms of income. It's the rich. In New York City, the top 1% is people who make something on the order, or households that make something on the order of $450,000 a year. Well, that could be somebody who's a lawyer and an anesthesiologist. Easily make $450,000 a year, and I don't think that that's the enemy. If we think of class only in terms of income, with the broad middle class as the characteristic population, with a fringe of rich and poor at the margins, which is the typical way in which we understand class, I think we really do miss what is actually the power dynamics in the society, and we miss what are the issues and the tasks and the alliances and the enemies that we have in our work. And of course, as long as that 1%, 99% is thought of in terms of income, the rich and everybody else, it just continues to feed that misrepresentation and misapprehension of the social structures and the social dynamics in the society. So I would say that the 1% really is, metaphorically speaking, the capitalist class. And actually, most people in the Occupy movement talked about the 1%, not so much in terms of the rich. They talked about it in terms of the corporate elites and the financial managers and the banks. And those were the people who were responsible. So there was an understanding of this class element to it. But in the general popular discussion, 1% became an income category. And I think that we need to rescue out of that Occupy lexicon the notion that the problem is this 1% is the corporate elite, is the financial elites. And who are this capitalist class? These are the people who give strategic guidance to the society and to the business world. These are the people who give strategic guidance to not only their own businesses, but to the organization and direction of the society as a whole. Now, we talked earlier here this afternoon about, can the working class provide a strategic guidance to itself? We're not trained. Working people are not trained, union leaders are not trained to think strategically at that level. And I think that that is something that we need to learn how to do, and we need to take on as a direct task. How do you think strategically about the power relations in the society? And again, on the question of power, if we see class as a question of power between labor and capital rather than income, it helps us to understand the intersections of class with race and gender. Because race and gender are not questions of income, although obviously there are income consequences to the power differentials of gender and race, just as there are income consequences to class dynamics. But race and gender are power relationships, and so is class. And if you separate out class as income from race and gender as power, it makes it all the more difficult to integrate those into a common understanding of who we are as individuals, as human beings, and as social forces. So I think, again, this metaphor that the Occupy movement has given to us has to be really reconstituted in these kinds of class terms. So if you understand that the problem is this 1%, actually, my work shows that this capitalist class is really 2%. Of the population, and the working class is 63%, the people who actually do the work and who don't have a whole lot of control over the content and the pace of the work, 63% of the labor force. Now, there is a middle class of professional people, of small business owners, of managers and supervisors. It's about 35% of the population, but it is, and it's a very important part of society. That middle class is not middle in terms of income, it's middle in terms of its relationship to the basic power grid of the society of labor and capital. So without going into all of the gory details of that, let me just say here that if we're looking at this capitalist class or the metaphorical 1%, and we say, well, we have to go get those people and limit their power. We have to go get to those people and change the power relationships. Quite true. You know the old fable about the mouse and the cat? And the mice are playing, and the cat comes, and the cat eats a mouse at night. And all the other mice are just terrified. Next night, damn, the cat comes back and eats another one of them. Well, the third night, the mice are having a meeting. And they're saying, what are we going to do? Because if we go out of this hole and go play around in that kitchen, that damn cat is going to come and is going to eat one or two of us. What are we going to do? And some mouse says, I got it. We're going to take a bell, and we're going to put that bell around the neck of that cat. So when the cat comes, the bell will ring, we'll hear it, and we'll run away. Very cool. The fable ends with one mouse saying, yeah, good. Who will bell the cat? And until we answer that question, we can have all the understanding we want about how we have to go after the corporate elite. The answer to who will bell the cat is working people. Because working people have the capacity to do it, because working people are the majority of the population. The name of my book on this question, The Working Class Majority, that's a title for a reason. when we talk about working people in this country, we're not talking about some special interest. We're talking about the majority, the overwhelming majority of the people of this country. And if we're talking about poverty and the poor, if you think about class in terms of income, rich, middle, and poor, well, there's the poor at the bottom of society. And it says in the Bible, the poor shall always be with us. And there they are. No. If you think about class in terms of the power relations that I'm trying to get at here, where you've got a capitalist class, a working class, and then a middle class in between, poverty is something that happens to the working class. So if you're concerned about the poor, if you're concerned about dealing with poor people, you really need to be concerned about mobilizing and organizing the strength and capacity of working people. So here, I think, I just want to say one word about this question about socialism, which was not in that Occupy speech and is not in my piece in the book, because that's just a transcript of the Occupy talk. You know, we can talk a lot about what is socialism, what isn't socialism. To me, the centerpiece of socialist society and socialist politics, those are two different things. You know, socialism could be a political philosophy and critique of capitalism, and socialism can mean a social system. But in whichever sense of the word socialism we want to take it, I would say the centerpiece of it is it's for working people. Working people have power, working people have authority, working people have moral standing. And to me, if we talk about building socialism or constructing a socialist society or having socialist politics, the centerpiece of that has got to be whatever else and whatever other organizational issues are there, the centerpiece of it has to be, does it advance the lives and the dignity of working people? If it does that, that's socialism. If it doesn't do that, that's some other damn thing. And I think that what we need to understand is that socialism isn't just a state, an endpoint. Socialism is a process. It's a process of bringing working class people to power and keeping them in power. And that process is something which doesn't require that we have already reached it before it's in place, right? So that is where I think if we talk about imagine socialism, we have to talk about imagining what does it mean to bring power, capacity, and dignity to work. Power, capacity, and dignity to working people. Whether they are white or black, whether they are Hispanic or Asian or native-born or foreign-born, men or women, gay, straight, doesn't matter. Those are the checkpoints for what does it mean. Now, if we're going to talk about this kind of social transformation and this process, this historical process, we do have to understand what we heard right at the beginning of today's discussion. We're talking about dealing with people who are killers. Let's just not forget that. This is not Parcheesi we're talking about playing here. This is not Tiddlywinks. These people are killers. They are killing people today as we stand here. And they are killing people in this country, they're killing people overseas, and they make a principle out of it. You cannot be president of the United States until you are a declared and committed killer. That is a job description. Let us not hide from that fact. Now, Martin Luther King talked about the arc of the moral universe. Sometimes it's been recast as the arc of history. And he said, it's long, but it bends towards justice. Long means it takes a long time. You think about when was the 20th Amendment that gave women the right to vote? 1920. But when was Seneca Falls? 1848, 72 years. You know, when was the Fair Labor Standards Act passed that got the 8-hour day? Well, 1938. But when was Haymarket? 1886. 52 years. Takes a long time. So we're talking about an historical process of liberation that takes a very long time. But that arc of moral history, that arc of history, that arc of the moral universe does, in fact, bend towards justice. It really does. But we have to bend it. We have to bend that arc of justice. And that means those of us who have been around bending for a while, we have to keep doing that. And working with young people, and working with the people of all races and genders and sexes and orientations who are out there to bend that son of a bitch so that it works the way we want it to work. And it's not waiting for or imagining some end state, because we cannot imagine what that end state will be. If we talk about the arc of history is long, think about what is this is 2013. Go back 35 years. That's not too far back. 35 years ago was 1978, was it? Well, how different was the world in 1978 from the world today? In culture, in technology, in politics, in international relations, in everything. 1978, go back 35 years from that. It's 1943. Well, again, how different was the world? Could you have imagined in 1943 what 1978 would be like? No way. Today is 2013, 35 years from today. When is that? 2048? You cannot imagine what that world is going to be like. You're going to be in it, God willing, and the cricks don't rise. You're going to be in it. Well, and probably me neither. But you know what? A whole generation of people is going to be there, and we are here to try to say, imagine what that's going to be. And you can't. If you think that you know or can imagine what the world will be like 35 years from now, you're making it up and smoking dope. But what you can do is imagine what you have to do today to advance the power, dignity, and organizational capacity of working people. That is what we have to do. And in doing that, those are the people who are going to create the future for themselves. We aren't going to create that future by writing out a blueprint for what the good world is going to look like and then go say, okay, this is what we're fighting for. That's a recipe for a dead end. What it means to do politics is to give power and to give capacity and to give dignity to the people of the country so that they can create their own future as it unfolds. That is what we have to do. That is what the political process is. And to me, that is what socialism is as a process, as a political agenda. And that, let me just finish up by saying, is not just a domestic matter. Capitalism is a global system. Class dynamics are global dynamics. And there's no reason to believe that the working class in this country has less to learn from Bolivia or from France or from Greece or from Mozambique than it has to learn from Kansas City. There's no reason to believe that the working class in this country, which is composed of people who come from Greece and Mozambique and Kansas City, have things to say to one another across borders. And we need to be aware and conscious of that and create those connections and create that openness and flow. And in that regard, let me just put in a plug for U.S. Labor Against the War and the organizational work that we're doing in the labor movement in the United States in unity and in solidarity with the Iraqi labor movement. There is a session on the international labor movement, international labor solidarity, and the work that's being done by the steelworkers and by the U.S. Labor Against the War and others in extending a global reach for this empowerment of working people. And I'll be there talking about what we're doing in conjunction with the Iraqi labor movement. So I'll quit with that right now, and we have some time here for discussion. Thank you.
That was Michael Zweig, professor of economics at Stony Brook University, speaking at the Left Forum in New York.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.